Radio.
Welcome to Mysterious Circumstances Podcast. Sorry about my absence for the last few weeks. To be perfectly honest with you, I wanted to take a couple weeks off, not really have to worry about researching or recording or editing or doing any of that. So, I am back with a good two-part series on the death of Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix is a personal hero of mine. When I was 14 years old, he is literally the reason I wanted to start playing guitar. That's how that all started, so I really, really love this man. I really do. He is, he's legend. There was just something about him, and he had his own way of doing things, and, you know, you just gotta appreciate it. But before we go on with the episode, I do have to thank new Patreon subscribers. We have Arlene Ogston, Joe G., Mary Conley, and then I have to thank Roxana for hitting me on the Venmo. If anybody would like to check out the tiers on Patreon, we always have a lot of stuff going on, at least 3 episodes a month. You can go check out the tiers at patreon.com/mysterious circumstances and then Venmo for one-time donations at MC Podcast. I will not be reading reviews. I know I said I was going to. I'm going to at the end of part 2. I have a few accumulated. I want to get this episode out. That's why I'm also going to state some of my sources after the episode as well, because we need to get rolling with this bad boy.
On September the 18th, 1970, the world learned that one of history's greatest guitarists was dead.
The Jimi Hendrix experience is over. The acid rock musician died today in a London hospital, apparently from an overdose of drugs.
He told the crowd, "I've been dead a long time."
The rather questionable circumstances of his death, very rushed, doesn't take the time to reconcile the different witness testimony surrounding his death.
But take it for fact, in just the past 4 years, Jimi Hendrix became one of the best-known, highest-paid artists in recording history.
And he looked me square in the eyes and said, "I won't be here." And I said, "What do you mean, won't be here?" He says, "Is it because I won't be in my body, I'll be dead."
But it is known that today, Jimi Hendrix is dead, an overdose.
I'd asked him, would he be going back to Seattle? He's like, he said, "Next time I go to Seattle, it'll be in a pine box."
The autopsy is very questionable because it basically says that he died in his own vomit. And a later study revealed it was actually drowning with large amounts of red wine.
Out of the blue, he said to the reporter, "I doubt I'll live to be 28 years old."
And then you get these very mysterious fatalities around the people who are close to him.
But just how did Jimi Hendrix die?
There's a lot of context to Jimi Hendrix the last few months that he was alive, and in part 2 we're going to cover more of that because that's when we're going to get into the theories. We're going to do a deep dive, we're going to go through, you know, probably the 3 most popular or the 4 most popular. There's so many different theories out there, but only about 4 of them seem pretty plausible. So this episode is going to be the timeline, and it's going to be why people think that something shady happened to Jimi Hendrix. And this is why I wanted to do this part separately and then do the theories in the next episode, because this one is going to be a lot of information thrown at you. And if I would have combined both episodes, it would have been like 2.5 hours maybe. And I want you guys to remember some of this shit. So we're going to start off on September 17th, 1970. Now, it is still highly debated. A lot of the times and a lot of the stuff going on in his last 48 hours. I mean, even his last 24. You know what I mean? But here's where we're going to start. He spent most of his day in London with a girl named Monica Daneman. He had met her in early 1969. She says that they were engaged at the time of his death. There is absolutely no proof of that other than her saying it. All right. Jimmy was a little bit of a ladies' man. All right. Maybe more than a little bit of a ladies' man. He was he loved the women. All right. So Monica Daneman, she is previously from a very well-to-do family, very wealthy family out of Germany. She had met Jimmy. She fell in love with him. Whether it was, a mutual type thing, you know, still remains to be seen. So he woke up late that morning on September 17th at her apartment in the Samarkand Hotel. By around 2 p.m., he was sitting in the garden area outside the apartment. He was, taking in some tea. And according to Monica, it was him, her, and another woman named Devin Wilson. Devin Wilson was a friend of Jimmy's for a few years, and she was the one that would hook him up with the drugs and the women whenever he needed anything. She was a very well-known person in rock circles at that time in the late 60s. She actually passed away in 1971. Her death is still a little bit weird as well, which makes this just a little bit more interesting. But anyway, it's those three. According to Daneman, that's who was there. Now, according to Daneman, she says that they were talking about just random things. They were trying to design, like, drawing up pictures for the new album covers and shit like that. And she said that Jimmy specifically told her to start chilling out on the drugs a little bit and to watch out for people who might want to hurt her for being associated with him. She made it a point to say, he kept telling me to remember what he's saying. A little bit odd, okay? So there were some photographs taken. Of course, some of his last photographs, him holding his favorite Fender, which was called Black Beauty. There is one author named Tony Brown. He looked at the pictures. He's actually a pretty known author about the last, final days of Jimi Hendrix. And he straight up says, he's like, listen, man, Jimmy doesn't look healthy in these photos. You know, his face is puffy. You know, very few of the pictures does he even attempt to smile. And Jimmy has a lot of shit going on in his life right now. And like I said, we're going to break that down in the theories in part two, all right? Because there's a lot of context going on with a lot of these different theories. I don't want to overload you guys with too much. Just remember that. So at about 3 p.m. on the 17th, according to Monica Daneman, they had left the apartment to use the bank. They continued on to Kensington Market, where Jimmy signed an autograph for a young boy. He purchased a leather jacket, and he ordered some shoes. At 8 p.m., he briefly spoke with his ex-girlfriend, Kathy Etchingham. Remember that name, because she will come up towards the end of this episode. And he invited her to visit him at his hotel, you know, later that night. She declined the invitation because she already had some other arrangements, you know, that she had to go to and shit like that. And she later came out and admitted that she had regretted that choice ever since. She had regretted that decision. Now, Kathy Etchingham is an important person because she was Jimmy's girlfriend, among many, but she was... They were in a relationship from like 1966 until early 1969 when they kind of drifted apart. Kathy Etchingham is the inspiration for the song The Wind Cries Mary. Her middle name is Mary. So actually there were more than one song written about Kathy. They were still friends though. After this, Hendrix and Daneman went to the Chelsea Antiques Market where Hendrix purchased more clothing and... They made another stop for him to buy some writing paper, which he would use to, write his final lyrics, you know, later that night. And they ended up meeting up with Devin Wilson as she was walking down the road. Hendrix asked Daneman to stop the car so he could get out and talk with Wilson. And Devin Wilson invited Hendrix to a party later that evening, and Monica Daneman becomes extremely jealous over this. You know, she was sitting there just eyeballing the shit out of Devin Wilson and everything else the whole time that they were talking. Now, if you remember, supposedly earlier that day, according to Monica Daneman, all three of them were sitting around and chilling out and all this other shit. So, a little bit of different tone there. Now, later on, a guy named Philip Harvey invited Monica Daneman and Hendrix to tea. They accepted. Before they went to Philip Harvey's, they stopped at the Cumberland for a very quick stop. While they were there, Hendrix makes a bunch of telephone calls. Daneman said that he called his lawyer, Henry Steingarten, asking him to find a way out of his contract with his manager, Mike Jeffrey. And then he called producer Eddie Kramer. He left a voice message for him. Now, Mitch Mitchell, one of the members of the band, he said that he called Hendrix at the Cumberland on September 17th after having been asked to do so by Jerry Stickles, who had spoken to Hendrix just a few minutes before that. And I know I'm throwing a lot of names out here, but just try to keep up. Mitchell said that during the phone conversation, Hendrix agreed to join him around midnight at the Speakeasy Club because they had already arranged for a jam session there. So Jimmy says, oh yeah, I'll be there. After they leave the Cumberland, Jimi Hendrix and Monica Daneman go with Philip Harvey to his apartment, and they arrive there at around 5:30 p.m. While they were there, they smoked some hash, they drank some tea and wine, and Philip Harvey was there with two of his female friends, and him and Jimmy were just kind of discussing their careers and shit like that. But these two other girls that were there were all over Jimmy, all right? I mean, they were, you know, filling up his wine glass. They were legit all over this dude. And Monica Daneman gets really fucking jealous and pissed off about it. So sometime around 10 p.m., Monica Daneman, she was not really in any of the conversations going on. She is jealous right now of Jimi Hendrix having these two chicks all over him. You know, and according to Daneman, they're engaged and all this other shit and they're in love. You know, take that information as you will. So it said that she becomes visibly upset. So they got into this big blow-up argument, and she ends up just storming out of the apartment mad as fuck. Jimi Hendrix follows her out. The argument didn't end there, and she starts calling Jimmy a fucking pig. That's a direct quote from Philip Harvey. It's quote-unquote, you fucking pig. And Philip Harvey, you know, he's kind of worried about the fact that they're out there fucking yelling in this huge argument. He doesn't want any kind of attention from the police at this time because they're hanging out, partying their asses off. Nothing but hash and alcohol, but still, they, you know, had some stuff on them. So he asked them to quiet down. Now, Philip Harvey again says Daneman, quote, verbally assaulted Hendrix in the most offensive possible way, end quote. And that's all he would say about it. So about a half an hour after this, they were literally out there arguing for like 30 minutes, all right? After it was done, Hendrix comes back into the apartment. He apologizes to everybody. He ends up leaving with Monica Daneman about 10 minutes later at 10:40 p.m. Now at 11 p.m., Daneman said she then prepared a meal for them at her apartment, and they shared a bottle of white wine. Sometime after returning to the apartment, Hendrix did take a bath, and he wrote a poem titled The Story of Life. And if you have not had an opportunity to read this, for Jimmy's last thing that he ever wrote, it is awesome. It is absolutely amazing. Gives me chills just thinking about it, you know. I know I posted a little bit of it in the Facebook group, and everybody's like, this is perfect. It's Jimi Hendrix's last thing he ever wrote, and it was actually later turned into a song as well. I can't remember off the top of my head who ended up actually turning it into a song, but Hendrix originally wrote it as a poem. He probably would have turned it into a song. But anyway, moving on. At approximately 1:45 a.m. on September 18th, Daneman drove Jimi Hendrix to the party that Devin Wilson had invited him to earlier that day. Now, this was hosted by a guy named Pete Cameron, who was one of Jimmy's friends and somebody who he was in business with. Now, one thing that you have to observe about this party is that Jimmy didn't actually invite Monica Daneman. He just wanted her to give him a ride there. I think partly it was because Devin Wilson was there. You know, I don't think him and Monica Daneman were as close as she portrayed them to be. So while he's at the party, Hendrix is complaining to Pete Cameron about some of his business problems. He ate a little bit of food and he took at least one amphetamine tablet. Now, approximately 30 minutes later, at about 2:15 a.m., Monica Daneman starts ringing the apartment's intercom asking for Jimi Hendrix. She starts getting loud. She starts banging on the door. She keeps ringing the intercom, and Jimmy did not want her there, and he kept telling her to go away. Another guest who was there, a woman named Stella Douglas, She asked Monica, Jimmy just wants to hang out, like, come back later, like, leave us the hell alone. Like, they were literally outside the window yelling at Monica Daneman to fucking leave, all right? Because, like I said, she's banging on the door, she's ringing the intercom, she's out there yelling, all kinds of shit. So about 15 minutes later, at 2:30 a.m., according to another guest, Angie Burden, and she is the wife of Eric Burden, she said that when Monica Daneman came back, Stella Douglas confronted her again, and she was a little bit more rude about it. And she was like, listen, you need to leave. Like, Jimmy does not want you here. None of us want you here. It didn't matter, dude. Monica Daneman was still demanding to speak to Hendrix. None of this shit bothered her. She's still banging on the doors, outside yelling, hitting the intercom button and yelling and shit. And Angie Burden, when she talked about it, she said he got angry because she wouldn't leave him alone. And that's a direct quote, right? So according to Angie Burden, all the other guests continued to start shouting out the windows at Daneman, asking her to fucking leave because she was just being crazy, right? So at 3 a.m., Hendrix pretty much just gave up, all right? And he talked to Daneman for a little bit, and then he unexpectedly left the party at around that time, right around 3 a.m. He was going to go back to his apartment at the Cumberland, but his favorite guitar was at Monica's, so he went back to her apartment with her. Now, sometime after 3 a.m., Daneman, who is the only eyewitness to Hendrix's last hours, says she prepared two tuna fish sandwiches for them after arriving back at her basement apartment. About an hour later, at about 4 a.m., Hendrix, who was struggling with a little bit of insomnia because he had taken some, you know, amphetamine pills, at least one, just a few hours before that, he asked her for some sleeping tablets. She later said that she refused his request, hoping he would fall asleep naturally. Daneman said she actually took a sleeping tablet sometime around 6 a.m., and Hendrix was still awake. Now, she says, and this is according to the inquest that was held, sometime between 10 and 10:20 a.m., she awoke to find him sleeping normally in bed next to her. She said she then left to go purchase a pack of cigarettes. Around 11 a.m., she arrives back to the apartment. She found him in bed. He was breathing, but he was unconscious and unresponsive. At 11:18 a.m., she called for an ambulance. At 11:27 a.m., the ambulance arrived. The ambulance crew members were Reg Jones and John Sua. They arrive at the Samarkand. Now, please remember those two names. They are critical in this episode. At 11:30 a.m., police officers Ian Smith and Tom Keene responded to a call for police assistance from the ambulance control center. Reg Jones commented, "Once the police arrived, it seemed like no time at all. We got Hendrix off to the hospital as quick as we could." Monica says during this inquest, she was assured by the ambulance crew that he would be okay. She wanted to go with him to the hospital. At 11:35 a.m., Monica goes with Jimmy and the ambulance crew, and they leave the hotel to take Jimi Hendrix to St. Mary Abbott's Hospital, and they arrived at 11:45 a.m. Monica says that she did travel with the ambulance, and when she got there, she waited in the parking lot for news on his condition. She said that a nurse came out to tell her that he was in bad shape, and then the nurse told her the medical team could save him. Now, the medical registrar, Martin Seifert, stated, "Jimmy was rushed into the resuscitation room. He was put on a monitor, but it was flat. I pounded his heart a couple of times, but there was no point. He was dead." Now, according to Seifert, the attempt to resuscitate Hendrix lasted just a few minutes. The surgical registrar, John Bannister, commented, "He was cold and he was blue. He had all the parameters of someone who had been dead for quite some time. We worked on him for about half an hour without any response at all. Then he later stated, on admission, he was obviously dead. He had no pulse, no heartbeat, and the attempt to resuscitate him was merely a formality. And then Monica says, a nurse came to the parking lot and told her that at 12:45 p.m. on September 18th, 1970, at the age of 27 years old, Jimi Hendrix was dead. And of course, the whole world blew up, okay? You guys got to understand, like, Jimi Hendrix exploded on the scene, all right? We'll give you a quick history here. Like, within 3 years, you know, maybe 4 years, actually, this dude was the biggest rock star. He could do things on the guitar that nobody had ever seen before. Nobody had ever heard this shit. And the way he did his music, which is why I love this guy so much, he was so unique in the way he did his music. He could make an album with blues, R&B sounds. He could pull out an acoustic guitar and just... The way he wrote, the way he did his music, there was nothing like it before him. And of course you have, you know, he's eccentric. He's a free spirit. He's a free soul, man. So when he died, the news went crazy. And of course all these rumors start circulating. Well, he OD'd on heroin. Well, it was an overdose. All right, Jimi Hendrix never did heroin. All right, he got caught with it at the border of Canada, I believe, but he had never actually done heroin before. A lot of people believe that Mike Jeffrey set him up, you know, to get busted like that so he would rely on Mike Jeffrey a little bit more. We'll talk about that in part two a little bit more, trust me. But there's all these rumors. Now, here's where some of the stories and shit start making people more interested in what really happened. At 4 p.m. that day on September 18th, Monica Daneman told Police Sergeant John Shaw, "We went to sleep at about 7 a.m. When I woke up at 11, his face was covered in vomit and he was breathing noisily. I sent for an ambulance and he was taken to the hospital. I also noticed that 10 of my sleeping tablets were missing." Now, if you notice, her story has already changed. Now, this is why you guys have to pay attention to this shit. So let's go into the autopsy and the coroner and all this shit real quick. But before we do that, let's take a quick word from our sponsor, Manscaped. Support for Mysterious Circumstances is brought to you by Manscaped. Who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming champions of the world? Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped just launched their fourth-generation trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right, the 4.0. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer just for you, 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code MYSTERIOUS at manscaped.com. Imagine shaving with a sleek, well-designed, and optimized trimmer that makes shaving time your favorite time in the bathroom. I'm one of the first people to try the new 4.0, and I love the performance of this thing. The craftsmanship and details on the 4.0 are next level. I tell you what, you know, you use the same trimmers for a long time, they get dull, okay? There's been a couple instances, not really proud of. You know, I'm in a hot hurry, man. I'm trying to, like, get this date riled up. I'm in the bathroom, going to town. If the teeth on the trimmer are dull, you're just ripping hairs out, dude. And then you got to worry about cutting the shit out of your nuts because you get a little bit too close, whatever the case may be. Dude, I've done it before. No pun intended, but the damn bathroom looked like a murder scene because I'm out here bleeding by my balls and then they scab up and it just looks weird. It's very uncomfortable. There's just no confidence there. That's what I love about the Lawnmower 4.0. It is smooth. The teeth move back and forth real fast so you don't have to worry about pulling hairs out as opposed to cutting them off. I can't recommend this enough. Manscaped engineered the ultimate groin and body trimmer by focusing on intelligent functionality and an incredibly comfortable grooming experience. Their fourth generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced safe skin technology, and it makes me feel a lot more confident when shaving the family jewels. The upgraded trimmer includes a multi-function on-off switch that can engage a travel lock. It also gives you the ability to turn the 4000K LED spotlight on and off when needed for a precise shave. The Lawnmower 4.0 even allows you to customize your trim through additional guard lengths with sizes 1 through 4. And did I mention the wireless charging? The new wireless charging system uses less electromagnetic induction, which can help battery length last even longer. So men, if you've been shaving with the same nut trimmer on your face, you've been doing it all wrong. No person wants to end up with pubes in their mouth, alright? It's time to get your own ball hair and body trimmer with Manscaped to make me time the best time and enhance your confidence with some nice, smooth boys. Your balls will thank you. Now get 20% off and free shipping with the code MYSTERIOUS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code MYSTERIOUS. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. To determine the cause of death, the coroner, Gavin Thurston, they ordered obviously a post-mortem examination. This was performed a few days later on September 21st by Professor Robert Donald Tier, who is a forensic pathologist. Tier reported that Hendrix was well-nourished and muscular. He said that there was no stigmata of intravenous drug addiction. Once these marks are in the skin, they never go away. In this case, there were no marks at all. Now, Tier did observe that the right side of Hendrix's heart was widely dilated, but he found no evidence of valvular heart disease. He discovered a partially collapsed left lung and 400 milliliters of free fluid in Hendrix's chest. Both lungs were congested, and vomit was found in the smaller bronchial tube. According to Tier, Hendrix's stomach contained a medium-sized, partially digested meal in which rice could be distinguished. Tier concluded that Hendrix's kidneys were healthy and his liver was congested. His bladder was half full of clear urine. He stated that Hendrix's blood alcohol content was 100 milligrams per 100 milliliters. Now, this is enough to fail a breathalyzer test, and this is the equivalent of about 4 pints of beer. Tier reported that analysis of Hendrix's blood revealed a mixture of barbiturates consistent with those from Vesperex. Those are the sleeping tablets that Monica Daneman said were missing. And Tier estimated that drug concentrations translated to ingestion of 1.8 grams of barbiturate, 20 milligrams of amphetamine, and 20 milligrams of cannabis. Tier gave the cause of death as inhalation of vomit due to barbiturate intoxication, and he did not even attempt to determine Jimi Hendrix's time of death. Then, a couple days later, on September 23rd, coroner Gavin Thurston begins an inquest. On September 28th, 5 days later, after this whole inquest, he concluded that Hendrix had aspirated his own vomit and died of asphyxia while intoxicated with barbiturates. The kicker is, he believed every single word of Monica's story. She was the only witness called at the inquest. The medical team at the hospital was never questioned. The ambulance crew on the scene was never questioned. The cops on the scene were never questioned. Only Monica Daneman. And he believed every single word of her story, even though the same day, just within 4 hours, she tells a different story. Now, Gavin Thurston commented, "The cause of death was clearly inhalation of vomit due to barbiturate intoxication, but there is no evidence as to intention to commit suicide. If the question of intention cannot be answered, then it is proper to find the cause of death and leave an open verdict," which the verdict of his death was left open. Monica Daneman later stated that Hendrix had taken 9 of her prescribed Vesperex sleeping tablets. These were intended to be taken in half-tablet doses. 9 tablets amounted to 18 times the recommended amount. Now, I know you guys are like, oh, well, yeah, that makes perfect fucking sense. Here's the deal. Jimi Hendrix was used to taking these pills. He had a tolerance built up. And I know a lot of you don't really consider that or might call bullshit on it, and that's totally fine. My job is to give you all the information. You decide for yourselves. I'm not here to sway any of your decisions. And we will get more into that also in part two as well. So, on September 29th, after Hendrix's body was embalmed by Desmond Henley, it was flown to Seattle, Washington. After a service at Dunlap Baptist Church on October 1st, he was interred at Greenwood Cemetery in Renton, Washington, which is where his mother was buried. More than 200 people attended the funeral, including a bunch of awesome musicians, the original Jimi Hendrix Experience members, Mitch Mitchell and Noel Redding. Miles Davis was there, Johnny Winter, John Hammond. I mean, they knew who this guy was, and they knew that they had just lost a legend. Now, here's where the shit starts getting wild, and here's why Jimi Hendrix's death is still questioned to this day. A guy named Tony Brown wrote a book called Jimi Hendrix, The Final Days, and he wrote this in 1997. He had been in regular contact with Monica Daneman from 1980 until her death in 1996. He visited her on multiple occasions. He spoke with her numerous times over the phone. Now, after he started contacting her initially back in the early 80s, Tony Brown came to the conclusion that her account of events of Hendrix's final days would change from one call to the next. And when he would question why her story would change from day to day, from call to call, she would threaten legal action against this dude. Well, Kathy Etchingham, who was Hendrix's ex-girlfriend, you know, the inspiration for a lot of his songs, talked about her earlier. Her and a guy named Steve Roby in the early 90s, I think it was around 91, they found out about all these inconsistencies on Monica's story. And they found out that the inquest was kind of bullshit because they took her word as gold and never questioned any of the other witnesses involved. They spent 3 years investigating the circumstances of Hendrix's death. Kathy Etchingham went and tracked down the ambulance drivers who had taken Hendrix to the hospital, and they told a whole different version of events. They said that when they got to Monica Daneman's apartment, it was empty and that Hendrix was fully dressed, laying on top of the bed with red wine spilled all over his shirt and pants. There was a large amount of red wine that was found in his lungs, but only a limited amount of alcohol was found in his blood and urine tests. The ambulance drivers also suggested that Hendrix had no pulse when they found him. And they said that he had more than likely been dead at least 3 hours at that time. Now, this totally contradicts Monica Daneman saying that Hendrix was still breathing and had a pulse when he reached the hospital. Now, Kathy Etchingham came to the point that Monica Daneman probably had some kind of role to play or had something to hide. And she found out that Monica Daneman had, in fact, been always constantly fighting with Hendrix, and the night before he died, they had gotten in several arguments. One of her theories was that, Monica Daneman had gave him this many sleeping pills to keep him at her apartment so he wouldn't go out and leave again. So Kathy Etchingham and Steve Roby start going into all these different statements that Monica Daneman had given, and all the ones that the cops and the ambulance crew and the medical staff, they start going into all this shit. Like I had mentioned previously, at approximately 4 p.m. on September 18th, this is just a few hours after Hendrix died, Daneman told Police Sergeant John Shaw she went to sleep at about 7 a.m. When she woke back up at 11, his face was covered in vomit, and he was breathing noisily. She sent for an ambulance. He was taken to the hospital. She also noticed 10 of her sleeping tablets were missing. Now, about a week later, on September 24th, in a statement given to PYL of the coroner's office, Monica Daneman said, quote, "I made a sandwich and we talked until about 7 a.m. He then said that he wanted to go to sleep. He took some tablets and he went to bed. I woke up at about 11 a.m. and I saw that Jimmy's face was covered in vomit. I tried to wake him, but I couldn't. I called an ambulance and he was taken to the hospital in Kensington. Prior to going with him to the hospital, I checked my supply of Vesperex sleeping tablets and found that 9 of them were missing. In Monica's initial statements, she said she woke at 11 a.m. on September 18th. During the inquest, she stated that she woke at 10:20 a.m. and then went and left to go buy some cigarettes, which she had never mentioned before, and that's why that's taken as gospel, because it was during the inquest. A year later in 1971, she wrote a manuscript in which she said she woke at 10 a.m. In 1975, when she was doing an interview, she stated that she awoke at 9 a.m. Now, according to Eric Burden, a friend of Hendrix's, Monica Daneman called him as the first light of dawn was coming through the window. In her statements to police and coroner's office, Daneman never mentioned calling Burden. Gary Stickles, who was Hendrix's stage manager, said he received a phone call regarding a problem with Hendrix between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. Mitch Mitchell said he waited for Hendrix at the Speakeasy Club for their jam session until they closed at 4 a.m., and then he had an hour and a half drive home. He received a phone call from Stickles, who told him Hendrix had died. This would have been at roughly 8 a.m., Now, although Monica Daneman claimed that Hendrix was alive when he was placed in the ambulance at approximately 11:30 a.m. and that she drove with him on the way to the hospital, the ambulance crew members, Reg Jones and John Sua, they arrived at the Samarkand. Like I said, the door to the apartment was wide open, the gas fire was on, the curtains were closed, and the apartment was dark. The crew called out several times, but never received a response, so they entered and found Hendrix fully clothed on the bed, alone, and apparently already dead. Daneman was nowhere to be found. According to Reg Jones, he said, "Well, we had to get the police. We only had him and an empty flat. So John ran up and radioed, and we got the aspirator. It was horrific. He was covered in vomit. There was tons of it all over the pillow. Black and brown it was. His airway was completely blocked all the way down. We felt his pulse, showed a light in his eyes, but there was no response at all." Like I had mentioned earlier, police officers Ian Smith and Tom Keene responded to the call for police assistance from the ambulance control center. They arrived at 11:30 a.m. Then, according to Reg Jones from the ambulance crew, Hendrix's bowels and bladder had released some of their contents prior to the ambulance crew's arrival at the apartment. Sua stated that the vomit was dry when they arrived, making use of the aspirator ineffective. Sua also said, "When we moved him, the gases were gurgling. You get that when someone has died." The police officer Ian Smith, who arrived, said the ambulance men were there, but Jimmy was dead. There was really nothing they could do for him. And then Sua goes on to say, when they were taking him to the hospital, there was just me, the casualty, and Reg, the driver, nobody else. And then Eric Burden comes back and says, "Monica Daneman didn't leave in the ambulance. She was with me." So, like I said, Kathy Etchingham and Steve Roby start interviewing all these people, and it's not matching up at all with anything Monica Daneman had said in any of her bullshit statements, right? And like I said, the cop Smith straight up says, "No, I remember quite clearly the door shutting on the crew and Jimmy. There was no one about. If she had been in the flat, they would never have called us to come. But because no one was there, he was dead, the circumstances were a little odd, suspicious, they radioed us in. It wasn't until later in the day that I found out that it was Jimi Hendrix." What the fuck is going on, right? So in about 1993 or so, after all this shit had been reviewed, the London Ambulance Service issued an official statement for what happened on September 18th, 1970. They said there was no one else except the deceased at the flat when they arrived, nor did anyone else accompany them in the ambulance to St. Mary Abbott's Hospital. So Kathy Etchingham, They had that private investigator who was helping them do all this shit. They gathered all this information, right? And they supplied the results of all of this, all of these interviews, all of these fucked up statements to the UK authorities and requested they reopen the coroner's inquest. Now, after several months of Scotland Yard doing an inquiry, Scotland Yard even went through and interviewed all these people, right? The officials for Scotland Yard, they were confident the request would be granted to open this back up. But a year later, the investigation proved inconclusive because Attorney General Sir Nicholas Lyle decided that proceeding with the investigation would not serve the public, owing in part to the excessive time that had passed since Jimi Hendrix's death. And it was closed right back up again, and nothing got looked back into. Now, Monica Daneman, you know, wrote a book, of course, trying to cash in on all that. She wrote a book called The Inner World of Jimi Hendrix, and she claims that it was Kathy Etchingham who introduced Hendrix to the lifestyle that claimed his life. In 1994, Philip Harvey, he had remained silent about the incident out of respect for his father, because his father was a nobleman. And he gave an affidavit after his father's death in 1994, and in his statement, he claims to have been mildly concerned for Hendrix's safety the night prior to him passing away. He was worried that Daneman might resort to serious physical violence against Jimi Hendrix. Then Kathy Etchingham sues Monica Daneman in 1996, right? She was found to be in contempt of court for repeating the offense because she kept fucking lying. She kept sticking to her story. Now, she was supposed to come back and give an official statement on what actually happened, the fucking truth. You know what happened right in between there? 2 days later, after she was found in contempt, and 2 days before she was supposed to go in front of all these people and tell the truth, she was found dead of an apparent suicide of carbon monoxide poisoning. So, when people say there's nothing really shady about what happened to Jimi Hendrix, I'm pretty sure they haven't really looked into this, all right? So I'll just say this. Part two, we're going to talk about his crazy-ass, scary manager, Mike Jeffrey. We're going to talk about Monica Daneman a little bit more. We're going to talk about him possibly. It's a theory. It's not really one of my favorite ones, but it does have to get mentioned about him being a political assassination. Then we do, unfortunately, have to go down the route of possible suicide. Stuff like that. We're going to break down those theories. And like I said, I'm not here to sway any decision. I'm here to give you all the information. You can decide for yourselves. But this right here is the timeline. And this is why people who have actually looked into this are like, man, this isn't right. Something is fucked up. This doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up. She's over here lying. Then she ends up fucking dead. Devin Wilson, she actually died in 1971. She fell out a 7 or 8 story window. So there's a lot of shit going on. Mike Jeffrey died in 73, I believe, in a plane crash. I mean, there's a lot of shit going on here and a lot of stuff. You also have two people that came forward and said that his manager, Mike Jeffrey, admitted to being involved in his death, that he was worth more to them dead than alive. And the fact that just a few months prior to Jimmy's death, Mike Jeffrey had actually taken out a £2 million life insurance policy on him. A lot of stuff going on here. I know there's a lot of information and it might seem like a little jumbled and confusing, and I apologize for that. We'll recap some of this stuff in part two, and let me go ahead and state some of these sources right quick. We have Eric Burden, who is a member of the band War. We have Kathy Etchingham, Jimmy's ex-girlfriend. She's the one who did a lot of the investigation. Steve Roby, who did some of the investigation. He is an author. He is a very respected Hendrix historian. He wrote 3 books that you might be interested in: Becoming Jimi Hendrix, Hendrix on Hendrix, and Black Gold, The Lost Archives. We also have an article written by Neetha Kay, in September of 2020, because that was the 50th anniversary, which it's crazy. It's been 50 years, 51 almost now. And the name of the article was called Jimi Hendrix, The Perfect Murder. We also have an article from loudersound.com written by Harry Shapiro. This was written about 2 years ago. And then we have an article from The Independent written by Sadie Gray in 2011. So there are some of the sources. I will state more in part two when we start getting into that shit. But I hope you guys enjoyed part one. I hope it wasn't too confusing. And I hope you realize why this is a very intriguing case. It's not just open and shut. Until next time, see you folks on the flip side.